Happy Friday. Good morning, everybody. Welcome into Mining Stock Daily. Trevor Hall here, delivering you this week's long form episode. We're going to talk a lot of things macro, especially the amount of new treasury debt that was auctioned off this week. We're going to touch base with a new guest from Three Circles Investment Newsletter. His name is Craig Shapiro. He is prolific on Twitter, providing not only a lot of information, but also some good commentary as well. So I welcome Craig on. We're going to talk a lot of things of what this bond market is telling us, what the action in the gold price is doing, and really some forward-thinking aspects about not only the Fed put, but the Treasury put, and also what could gold provide when this cycle is finally broken and we start moving into more of a growth-type pattern. It's a very interesting perspective from Craig. It's worth considering. Special thank you to Fireweed Metals, Arizona Sonoran Copper, Victoria Gold, and also Vizsla Silver for their continued support of Mining Stock Daily. And if you wouldn't mind, as always, please leave a review, click the share, the like, subscribe, all those things. It does us a tremendous amount of good getting in front of new people interested in metals and mining. All right, everybody, here's my conversation with Craig. Have a wonderful weekend. Be well. Mr. Craig Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us here on Mining Stock Daily. I assume this may be your first mining podcast you've been on.
Yeah. I think maybe first or second, but I've been following commodity markets for over 20 years, so I guess it was only a matter of time.
Yeah, well, you're very active online. On top of you writing the Three Circles Investment Newsletter, which you publish on Substack, you are prolific on Twitter, sharing your thoughts. You never shy away from sharing your quote unquote analysis of what's happening in markets. And obviously, it's been a tremendous couple weeks of what we've seen in general, not only in the equity markets but also in the treasury markets here. Before we kind of jump into the conversation, Craig, since this is your first time on this podcast, maybe give us just kind of a walkthrough of your career and, what you did before kind of jumping into the newsletter writing business.
Yeah. So I've been on the buy side for a better part of 20 years, working at various hedge funds on Wall Street, some pretty big names, Point72, Osprey Management, Graticule. Had my own firm called Circle Lane Capital, which was launched during the Trump era, and shut that down. And then, more recently, I've really just been managing my own family office money. But I've also kind of taken to writing more. I do some more consulting on macro economics, and now more recently, really just been kind of to grow that brand on Twitter and kind of get into it with people and kind of share my views. I feel like Twitter has become, a good repository for discourse in financial markets. And so I like engaging on there and trying to, push my process. I also find that writing is additive to my process. I like to write things down and kind of get my thoughts out there and then share them and see the pushback and kind of understand how the markets are taking or not taking things that I'm thinking about. So it's amplified my own trading and I enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, what corner of these markets do you feel most comfortable in? And maybe on the vice versa, which one of these corners of the market have you learned to kind of cut your teeth a little bit more the last few years?
Yeah. So when I started in the industry, it was at Osprey Management, which was a very big commodities hedge fund. Started there in 2002 and was there for, through the financial crisis. And so my background is on supply and demand dynamics for commodity industries and companies in the old economy. And so, I've had to grow that knowledge base and become a little bit more macro over time, understanding currencies, understanding the bond markets, et cetera. So I would say that's the avenue, that's the corner of the world where I focus a little bit more in. I don't really get into, big tech and AI and some of the secular themes going on there and kind of dealing with the drama of NVIDIA or Meta or Google or Microsoft, although obviously those have become, and Apple, incredibly important drivers for overall equity markets. But I find myself shying away from some of the secular mega themes. I prefer dealing in cyclicals and in short cycle and macro. find that, you know, be a little bit more my lane. So that's where I, that's where I like to traffic.
Okay. Well, I mean, head on a swivel here in the last 48 hours, you can even maybe say the last 3 days here. It is interesting watching these markets. You take a step back on Tuesday, I think it was Tuesday, Tesla puts out their financials, miss, but then, you know, Elon does Elon things to say they're work, you know, going to work on producing a more affordable EV. Markets eat it up, and that market cap rises. Vice versa, Meta itself hits their estimates, but then says they're spending a lot on AI R&D. Market doesn't like that and sells it off and loses $200 billion in valuation.
Yeah, look, these earnings prints are, you know, they are 50-50 shots. Really understanding the setup and understanding the dynamic of who's playing for the print is almost more important than whatever the company is going to say. You know, Tesla, well-shorted name into the print, you know, well-understood secular bear thesis. It really probably didn't matter what they said. That stock was going to go up on earnings. Now, you know, we'll digest that. News gets in, you know, information will get digested in the market, and folks will kind of reestablish that short thesis. But you just can't risk being overly exposed on any one of these individual earnings prints, because you know, if you're in a low vol multi-manager shop and you're too exposed, you get blown up. And similarly on Meta, right? This is a well-known bull thesis on AI. Folks are long the print, and you know, good number came in. Yes, there was some cautious commentary on AI CapEx. Didn't matter. Stock's going to get buried. Too many people are long it. So it's a bit of a, like you said, a head on a swivel. And tonight we have Microsoft and Google. So, more of the same for these stocks.
Well, the reason I asked you about those big names, the Teslas and the Metas, is because I do want to kind of follow up in here. There's been kind of the great term rotation is starting to peak itself around the corner more and more among analysts following the markets. And so I'd like to kind of pose that question to you, that rotation. We certainly had what we thought was going to be a great rotation about 2 years ago, away from tech into commodities. That was, you know, 2022 in the height of the cycling of the hiking cycle. That didn't live very long. But now we're starting to maybe have that being noticed once again. So when you talk about market rotation, do you agree with that movement? Are you seeing a rotation out of tech into more cyclicals? And, you know, what are the signs that maybe support that cause?
Yeah, look, I think it depends on your view about the direction of the economy, the direction of monetary policy, the direction of fiscal policy, and whether or not the rest of the economy is robust enough to take the mantle from big tech from an earnings perspective. And frankly, I'm suspicious. I don't believe that we are going to see a significant rotation out of big tech into small caps, for instance. I know there's some talk about that kind of rotation. I don't really see it. I mean, when you look at small caps, they're most exposed to higher interest rates. They're most exposed to labor costs, which are, you know, continuing to rise, and you know they run with tight margin, you know, small margins, where they have a lot of operating and financial leverage. And what the Fed is trying to do is they're trying to slow down the economy to return inflation back down to 2%. And so, what these cash-rich big tech companies have going for them is massive cash balances, right? And so they're earning 5% plus on those cash holdings, which is a buffer to their earnings growth, offsetting what typically happens, which is multiple degradation when we have a rise in interest rates. The small caps really don't have a similar dynamic in place. And so I don't really see that tech to small cap rotation. I think it's possible we will start to see some tech into defensive rotation as the economy slows. So I can understand why utilities will start to look a little bit better. I know there's an AI component now developing in utilities as power consumption is becoming, you know, an interesting theme. So maybe some rotation there, or maybe some rotation into healthcare as a defensive theme. But I don't really see a rotation out of big tech into cyclical parts of the economy. Now, what I do see, though, is, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into it, is these deficits in the U.S. Are inflationary, and they're leading to, you know, some longer term thoughts about the dollar and about commodities and about pricing of commodities. And so I can understand how energy precious metals and those types of companies, you know, may start to attract incremental capital. So I think it's, you know, yes, there'll be some rotation, but I don't see this massive out of tech into other areas of the markets developing, because I'm a little bit more sanguine on the view for forward growth and how the Fed is trying to slow growth in order to slow inflation.
Mm-hmm. Talk about its implications with the rising yields. I mean, that short end of the curve is rising once again. Last I looked, the 2-year was at almost 5% once again. But, you know, in 2022, those big tech stocks were absolutely punished with rising yields. Have we, yeah. Has the market shaken that off?
It's funny you mentioned that. I actually put a chart out today looking at the exact analog between 2022 and 2024. Actually lines up pretty good. And tech did underperform. But the whole, all equities were really soft. And so I do think there is a dynamic of that coming in here. I'm pretty negative on equities as an asset class, you know, here for the next, you know, couple months. I think back then what we saw, what we had was inflation reaccelerating and a Fed that was too slow to react to it and was forced to raise rates at a faster pace. And it was that dynamic of rates volatility and increasing rates at a faster pace that ultimately kind of introduced that volatility into the market and kind of led to that correction in equities. And I see a similar dynamic playing out now. Basically, you came into the year, the market was expecting 6 rate cuts. The Fed was only looking for 3 rate cuts, but nonetheless, we to start the year, the 6 rate cuts went away, but the 3 rate cuts were assured by the Fed, and financial conditions loosened materially. Animal spirits were reignited, inflation expectations moved higher, and now absolute inflation is reaccelerating and has been now for the last 3 months. So it seems to me like the Fed has made a mistake and now is rapidly or will have to rapidly kind of address that issue. And they've done so by kind of pricing out these rate cuts. And so Powell's last word before the blackout period really put to bed the June cut. And as you move through the year, you know, July is a very difficult time to start cutting because it falls right between the conventions. September is the last opportunity to cut. And then November is actually after the election. So, you know, if they don't cut in June, which it seems like they're not going to, they're not going to be cutting. I don't believe they're going to be cutting this year. And so the market is starting to pick up on that. And the data has, I think, has supported it, right? Because inflation has been reaccelerating. We saw this morning in this GDP data, what looks to be a fairly sizable reacceleration of inflation in the month of March. And there's some talk now, and we'll see tomorrow at 8:30, but core PCE for the month of March may come in as high as, you know, 0.45 or even 0.5. Some people are suggesting now versus an expectation of 0.3. Even 0.3 core is too high for bringing inflation back down to 2%. But if we're in the 0.4, 0.5% camp, then the Fed has really, I think, lost the plot here. And so as we start to introduce what I've described as dual-sided risk, where the Fed's next move is equally likely to be a hike as it is to be a cut, as that starts to become more priced in, I think equities are going to struggle. So that in that sense, the dynamic looks a fair bit like what we saw in the second quarter of 2022, which is a pretty horrific quarter for stocks. So, but I think all stocks will suffer in that environment, as opposed to seeing some out of tech into other areas rotation that keeps the indices afloat.
Okay, what are you seeing here in the bond market? I mean, we've had a number of auctions here. Secretary Yellen's really starting to put a little bit more short-term debt out there in the last week. And that 2-year yield, which has been my bellwether for the last 3 years of judging inflation, is creeping back up. It looks like it wants to bust over 5% once again. What would be the magnitude and signal if that 2-year yield were to go to 5.25 back up and hit that current Fed funds rate?
Yeah, I think it's exactly what we're seeing, which is this re-acceleration of inflation. The Fed made a decision in the fall, you know, maybe even in concert with the Treasury to pivot, right, in November at that November meeting, a substantial majority of Fed members who had previously been looking for a rate hike in 2020 in the fourth quarter of 2023 felt like, you know what, we're not going to deliver that rate hike. And then Yellen, similarly, at that quarterly refunding announcement, when people were looking for more duration issuance, she came in and said, maybe not so much. And so they precipitated this drastic loosening of financial conditions in order to prevent the economy from spiraling. And there had been some concerns back in the late fall that the economy was starting to slow and the labor market was slowing. And so they didn't want that to happen. Inflation had been coming down. And so they felt like, mission accomplished, we could pivot. But what they failed to realize is that the drastic loosening of financial conditions has a real impact on the economy. When you are signaling to the market that rate cuts are coming, market participants act accordingly. And we start to see animal spirits, rising, right? We start to see inflation expectations moving higher. We started to see corporate bond issuance through the roof as corporates were looking at the window open to refinance and kind of putting money, bringing in that capital at cheap rates. And that capital gets kind of redeployed into the markets through share buybacks or CapEx plans or what have you. And so there was real impact from that loosening of financial conditions. And that has led to this resurgence of inflation. And we've seen now 3 months in a row, and we're likely to see another month in April, which gets reported next month, of sequentially stronger inflation prints that are making it impossible for the Fed to achieve that last mile of getting inflation back down to 2%. So what the bond market is doing is the bond market is pricing out all of these cuts. And as the 2-year moves higher, that is a signal that we are going to get less rate cuts this year and next year, because the economy needs to be at these higher levels of interest rates for longer in order to actually bring inflation back down to 2%. So if 2-year yields go above Fed funds, that would be a pretty telling sign that the bond market believes the Fed does need to hike again. Obviously, we're not there yet, but we could be there. We could be there soon, especially if we get another CPI print in for the month of April that comes out in 3 weeks. That is is very hot. So I think the bond market is concerned about inflation, and the data out this morning kind of is more in that direction. Yellen has a well articulated supply schedule. Right, we knew this week that she was going to be issuing $213 billion. Worth of bonds, 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, and these 2-year floating notes. The demand for those has been, pretty good, but yields are significantly higher than they were for last auction. And so I think we're just going to get more of the same. We know Treasury's issuance calendar. We can talk about next quarter's, in a bit, but Treasury has a lot of bonds to sell every quarter from now to forever, right? 6% of GDP deficits, for as far as the eye can see. No appetite in DC to raise taxes, no appetite in DC to cut spending. So deficits are the lay of the land, and Treasury's got a lot of bonds to sell. And so the bond market is picking up on that, and inflation is running hotter than expected. So it's a tough time to be thinking about getting too long fixed income, which I think then makes it more difficult to want to be long duration equities.
And those debt payments, the interest payments on the national debt, continue to get higher and higher. Well, that is a huge, you're carrying the elephant uphill there on your back, Craig. I mean, it doesn't seem like Washington, D.C. seems to care, because they're stuck. I mean, everybody just seems absolutely stuck, to the point where I am almost, listening to a couple other people talk about the same subject, I might be coming around to the camp like where it just never will get solved. It's just going to go higher and higher and higher.
Look, there's a lot of dynamics in play here, but one I think that doesn't get enough airtime is that, in my view, the Fed enables this, because the Fed never allows the bond market to do its work. It never allows bond market vigilantes to come in and discipline dysfunctional government. Right, James Carville's famous, quote in the mid-90s about, wants to come back as the bond market, because he can enact real fear on policymakers. The Fed has elevated the smooth market functioning of U.S. Treasuries to its primary mandate. It basically wants to make sure that the Treasury market is always smooth functioning, that there's never any issues. And so at the first sign of any strain, it comes in and adds more liquidity always. Because that dynamic just makes it so Congress never has to do anything, and so it can just continue to kind of cut taxes and raise spending, whether it's the Republican Party in charge, you know, we blow the deficits out, or the Democrats are in charge, we blow the deficits out, and the Fed just sits there and allows it to happen. And look, I think we are starting to get closer to the point now where it's becoming a problem, right? Foreign demand for treasuries is going lower for a variety of reasons, you know, because of these deficits, but also because of the way that we're treating our enemies' holdings of reserves, right? I mean, think about sanctioning Russia in early 2022, what that dynamic has set in place for other countries and their desire to hold U.S. treasuries as reserves. I mean, if you are in jeopardy of eventually becoming an enemy of the United States, you can have your reserves expropriated or stolen from you and taken and given for other purposes, which is exactly what is happening to Russia right now. So if you're China, you're sitting back and you're saying, we don't like this. We're not going to be embracing this anymore. And so look at China's, holdings of U.S. treasuries over the last 2 years. I mean, they've been declining at an accelerating pace and are now below $800 billion. And I suspect we're going to find that China is in the selling of U.S. treasury camp, from now through the end of the year, providing more pressure on the bond market. So the foreign part of the bond market is starting to pick up notice of these deficits. And I think that's being reflected in interest expense. And so then the question is, what is the Fed going to do? Are they going to come in again and save the bond market and save the government? I mean, it just becomes more and more difficult for the Fed to do that when inflation is running well above target. So that is where the rubber hits the road. In my view, as inflation is reaccelerating, it becomes more difficult for the Fed to kind of come in there and maintain its independence and say, we're gonna cut rates. They have to stand back. They have to allow this to play out a little bit more and see some pain in the bond market, see some pain in risk asset prices, kind of remind people in DC that this is not a free lunch. These deficits can't exist forever. Yes, it takes a little bit of leadership at the Fed. Powell needs to stop saying things like fiscal policy is not our lane. He needs to come out and say, this is a real problem. We're not going to defend it. I'm not saying that he's going to do that, but that's what he should be doing. But we get those decisions from the Fed kind of every 6 weeks. We get decisions from Treasury about how they're going to issue coupons versus bills every 3 months. And so, we are moving to on that path of higher lows and higher highs for interest rates. And eventually we're going to have a much bigger problem. But, kicking the can has been a strategy for a long time. And I suspect, will continue to be. But gold market is starting to notice. Commodity markets are starting to notice. Real assets are starting to notice. Bitcoin is starting to notice, right? People are shifting capital away from U.S. treasuries into other stores of value. And I think that dynamic is going to remain with us for a very long time.
Yeah. There was a previous episode last week. It's called basically the war for hegemony, which we're seeing between East and West. And this continues to play out because in what you were just saying, reminded me of a couple news items, like lately. And we remember we go back when Russia attacked Ukraine, and we have talked about the U.S. freezing Russian assets, which turned out to be just an incredible moment in financial history, which really accelerated the tone of splitting and trying to step away from, U.S. fiscal dominance throughout the world. And this is starting to play out. I mean, we're just seeing news items that Secretary Yellen said she'd be prepared to use authority to sanction Chinese banks if necessary. Yep. She was just in China a week ago, quote unquote, talking about solar panels, which is complete baloney.
I mean, Blinken is there now.
It's like, what is going on? Like, have we not learned?
Yeah. Look, I think the U.S. is, how do I put this, right? I mean, I think the U.S. recognizes that its hegemonic status is declining. And so the question is, how long is the U.S. going to kind of hold on to the view that it remains the sole hegemonic power and is going to grow that over time? Or is it going to relinquish that control, kind of help establish a multilateral monetary order, which will allow for the dollar to weaken which will allow for the U.S. terms of trade to change, and will allow for a rebuilding of manufacturing in America, which will ultimately be a great bullish story for America and for the rest of the world. And I think you have voices in the U.S. government, whether it's in the State Department or Treasury Department, that are on both sides of that coin, right? Some people want to exist in a world, in a reality where the U.S. remains number one and the only number one by a long mile. And some people want to kind of move away from that. And so I think the speed with which we do that is uncertain. And it depends on who the leaders are, who the president is, what the Congress looks like. And so I think Yellen and Blinken kind of went to China to try to, you know, ask them politely to, you know, help, right? Revalue your currency. Stop dumping goods, become more of a global actor. And China's like, screw you. Like, we'll do what's good for China. You've been doing good, what's good for America for 50 to 100 years. Like, we're going to do what's good for China at the pace that we want to do what's good for China. What China has done, which is very different from kind of previous episodes of when the U.S. would face other superpowers, let's say, is that China now has the ability to price commodity purchases in RMB. It is a fundamental change in the monetary system, right? Before, oil and commodities only priced in dollars, excess reserves only stored in US treasuries, petrodollar system makes a lot of sense. Now, you're Saudi, you trade with China in RMB, you either get goods back from China, which you need, or any of those excess goods, excess trade balances, you store excesses in gold. And we're removing the dollar from that part of the monetary system. So I think that is going to continue. And the U.S. going and trying to threaten Chinese banks if they continue to support Russia is only going to accelerate that process, right? Anytime Yellen talks about sanctioning banks, it only means that China is going to be more likely to sell treasuries, more likely to sell U.S. assets. And so is that something that she wants to have happen? Or is she trying to create, you know, a crisis that kind of leads to the establishment of a new Plaza Accord or a new Bretton Woods? I don't know. But I mean, it's worth kind of, thinking about exploring these alternatives. But to me, it seems like we're moving into a multipolar trading world. Gold is being reintroduced as a neutral reserve settlement asset. And the U.S. can either like go along with that plan or fight it. I think when you have $35 trillion of debt and 125% of debt to GDP and a negative 65% net international investment position, the U.S. doesn't really have as many bullets to fight that and go on thinking it's number one, you know, forever. So hopefully the powers that be in government kind of push us in the right direction. But, you know, it's possible that they won't. We'll have to kind of react accordingly.
Yeah. If China does stop coming to the table and purchasing U.S. debt completely, isn't that detrimental for China? I mean, doesn't that hurt them in the long run as well? I mean, how obviously we're dependent on Chinese buying, but what kind of effects would that have on them if they just stop coming to the table?
I mean, look, I think they are, they access the U.S. market, right, for goods, right? U.S. is still a big important trading partner of China. I think if we move into a direction where it becomes a less copacetic trading environment, China will just sell goods into other countries, right? I mean, they'll sell goods, to their allied countries in emerging markets, other countries, other BRICS countries. BRICS is growing in its importance and the countries that are affiliated and associated with it. So, yeah, I mean, look, China has $800 billion of reserves in dollars. If they stop buying treasuries, maybe they run the risk of more tariffs and more threats against that trade in America. But hasn't that ship sailed already? Trump's already put massive tariffs on China. He's threatening to put more if he comes into power again. So, I don't know. I feel like China is making smart 50-year plus decisions, right? They want to reestablish themselves in the world order. They're not taking the advice from Western policymakers to stimulate their economy or save their stock market, right? They are gradually moving, into a place where they could kind of paper over this property market plus that's been going on and do it over time. But to the extent that China is able to continue to buy discounted energy from Russia, from Iran, and kind of deal in a mercantilist way and dump and selling goods globally, they're not in as bad of a situation as I think people think they are. And if you look back to the third quarter of last year, China selling a little bit of bonds of their treasury holdings led to a lot of pain for the U.S. bond market and forced Yellen to pivot, right? So who is really in the driver's seat here? Is it the U.S. and, you know, the way that they dictate terms of trade globally? Or is it China and their ability to kind of move the U.S. bond market in a large way with only a little bit of selling? The U.S. doesn't have all the cards here, right? I mean, China has cards to play.
Yeah. Complete weaponization of the bond market in geopolitics. It's just absolutely fascinating to watch. And Craig, you did talk about gold, and I think we should maybe kind of move this conversation in that direction. I love this tweet you put out not too long ago talking about gold in relation to the U.S. debt. And you talked about in 71 when Nixon took us off the gold standard, we had enough gold to cover about 25% of the official foreign dollar holdings. If we use kind of similar, if you assume that 8,100 million tons of gold at $2,300 an ounce, that's about $600 billion. However, just because the substantial amount of debt we have put on over the last few decades, now pushing $8 trillion.
That's just the foreign holding of our debt.
That's right? Just a foreign holding. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that only covers 7 to 8%
right,
of that, based on if we assume that is how much gold we continue to hold.
Yeah.
Why is this important? Why is this important to watch right now?
Yeah, look, it was a kind of a thought exercise. I started reading the book 3 Days at Camp David, which kind of goes through the process by which the U.S. went under to remove us from the gold standard. It's a fascinating book. I just started reading it. And so in the beginning part of the book, the author kind of references this math. And Luke Groman has talked a ton about this dynamic, about how much gold do we actually have in the U.S. to support the ability to pay back our debts, right? Before we were removed from the gold standard, foreign countries, could request gold, if they wanted it, instead of holding our bonds. And so, yes, we don't have that kind of system in place today, per se. But as the U.S. Continues to borrow into perpetuity, and as the U.S. kind of restricts foreign countries to buy assets in America, right? Look at the whole Nippon Steel. U.S. steel situation that's going on now. This is Japan. This is an allied country of the U.S. Japan is our biggest, supporter of you, an owner of U.S. treasuries. They want to buy steel assets in America to make cars in America, right? And our administration is saying no. I mean, so, foreigners are having an increased difficulty getting access to assets in America that can be used to generate tax receipts that can pay back bondholders. And so, I don't know. I mean, I just think, the U.S. has a certain amount of gold, and gold has been a part of the monetary order for thousands of years. And it seems like it's being reintroduced. So countries' gold holdings are going to be very important in understanding the value of currency. And so now that the U.S. only really has, 7 to 8% of gold holdings as a percentage of its foreign debt obligations, and it used to be kind of in the 70%, it peaked out at 150%. So look, if we have some sort of monetary reset, which the U.S. could mark up its gold in order to pay down its debts, let's say, and create some more fiscal space, that could be an outlet by which, we go through a transition, in a much more peaceful, seamless way, as opposed to kind of what we're choosing to do right now. So I thought it was an interesting, thought exercise. And when you think about the revaluation of gold, who's really going to complain about that, right? We're not going to see massive inflation kind of in real time. Even in the 70s when we did this, yes, we got inflation, but we got gradual inflation over time. We didn't get hyperinflation immediately. I think it would be a much bigger problem if, let's say, we, commodity markets were revalued and oil went to 100, $200 or $400, right? Mm-hmm. People would starve. The world would shut down if food prices ripped. But if gold goes up we add a zero, let's say, to the end of the gold price, you know, it's going to provide a tremendous amount of purchasing power to China, to Russia, to emerging market holders of gold, and amplify their consumers in a way that could actually rebalance global trade in a peaceful way. And so I think this is on the table. I have no, obviously, you know, it's speculation, but as gold is being more introduced into the monetary order again, I think we have to explore kind of how political leaders might think about a future where gold has been repriced at a significantly higher level and how the chips fall out. And so having only 7% gold coverage right now seems awfully low. But if, you know, the gold price quadrupled, then at least we'd be in the kind of low 20% camp, mid 20% camp that we were in 1971 when we decided to remove ourselves from the gold standard. So I don't know. It just seemed, felt like, you know, hard to have a framework, right, for valuing gold. And so this, I think, provided some context about how we should be thinking about it.
No, it's really interesting. I guess I've never thought about it. I mean, you did mention it's kind of speculative thinking, you know, forward thinking. Instead of gold being just like the safe haven asset against really terrible monetary policies by central banks and governments, that it actually becomes a foundation for sound growth in times of hegemony, right? So that's a very interesting way to think about it. I have not considered that, but I could understand why I need to give it some deep thought.
I think there were, you know, long periods of time, decades of time, where when the gold standard was in place and operating properly, where we had deflationary, a very low inflationary world, maybe even deflationary prices and prosperous growth. Yes, it became an issue at times, you know, around World War One, and then again with World War Two, as countries were coming on and leaving the gold standard and rearming, and so that may, you know, be a problem again in the future. But it has provided a framework in the past towards sound growth, towards disinflationary growth. But you know, the world has become so used to debt finance growth that you know, now, you know, potentially the chickens are coming home to roost on that. So we may have to start moving in a, you know, in a different direction. And so it's just worth exploring and thinking about those things. And I imagine political leaders are thinking about it, right? I mean, globally, central banks have not been buying U.S. treasuries on net in 10 years, right? 2014 was the peak. So, and since then, I think the U.S. debt has more than doubled. So foreigners are buying, you know, are not buying. The U.S. government is borrowing a heck of a lot more, and they're buying, and central banks are buying gold. So clearly, there are folks in you know, the upper echelons of power that believe gold is going to be part of whatever system exists after the dollar hegemony comes down. And so, kind of behooves us to try to think those things through and game theory and figure out and also invest, right? And also figure out kind of what works, what wins, what loses in those settings. But I think gold is gold is a winner.
Okay, I'm gonna kind of turn back. We got to do some forward thinking and stuff into next week, because the quarterly refunding announcement from the Treasury happens next week. This is coming off just a massive sale of treasuries this week. And this is always pretty telling. It gives you a sense of what their plan is for Q2. What are your expectations here, Craig? What are the things you're going to be really getting in the weeds about, want to get some clarity on them? This is real special macro people type talk. So make it simple for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, and I'm not, you know, an expert. I've just been forced to kind of understand these dynamics and focus on this QRA every quarter now, as it's become much more of a market moving event. And the reason it's become more market moving is the way that the Fed has conducted QT in such a passive way. And it's not even really QT. It's just balance sheet roll off, right? The Fed doesn't even sell assets. They just let let maturities roll off. So by doing that, they've actually allowed the Treasury to kind of take over monetary policy in a big way. And so the way that the Treasury decides to issue coupons versus bonds versus notes actually has a big impact on financial conditions and on the economy. And so these quarterly refunding announcements and the way that Treasury kind of builds up or draws down it's the Treasury general account, which is the Treasury's checking account, you know, really can move markets. And so, look, last October, when we had the bond market sell-off and term premiums moving higher and fears about debt sustainability in the U.S., inflation was coming down, growth was becoming a concern. Yellen felt that she had the ability there to kind of surprise the market with less duration issuance than had been expected. In the prior QRA in August, she said, we're going to do a lot of duration issuance. At that October meeting, she said it's going to be less than expected. And so there was markets kind of breathed a sigh of relief. Risk assets rallied, bonds rallied, dollar sold off, financial conditions eased, and all was good at that point in time. But there is now, again, an expectation that she's going to do something similar, and that she is going to kind of react to the pricing that we've seen over the course of the last few weeks and kind of provide another dovish pivot, because it's an election year. And mm-hmm. she wants to make sure that she stays in power and that the Biden administration stays in power. That is an assumption that the market is making based on what she did in October. But I don't really think it exists in a reality of what the Treasury is supposed to be doing with the debt composition, right? The Treasury has said that they expect over time to maintain between 15 and 20% of total duration in bills and the rest in bonds. Currently, we are between 22 and 23% of that. So the Treasury is violating that unspoken rule. And we are not in exogenous times. We are not in COVID. We are not in war. We are at full employment in America, and we are running deficits at 7% of GDP. This is not exogenous times. Treasury should be issuing more bonds to return that ratio back to that 15 to 20% range. Secondly, term premiums are low by historical standards. If you go back to, let's say, 2000, the average term premium for 10 years has been, the 10-year bond has been about 70 basis points. We're currently in the 15 to 20 basis points camp. So there is still incentive for Treasury to be issuing out the curve, because the market is giving Treasury kind of a free pass here on forward inflation expectations. The yield curve is still inverted. So why are we issuing short when we could be issuing long? So I think there are fundamental long-term reasons why Yellen should continue to issue duration in size, but it is a political year. It is an election year. And we don't exactly know what she's going to do. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to bet aggressively one way or another. I think we will have to react accordingly. It's possible that she will decide to issue less bonds, issue more bills. It's possible she decide to run down the Treasury General account more aggressively between now and the election in order to put more money into the economy. She could do any of these things. She has become more powerful than the Fed, right? The Treasury put on markets now is struck at a level closer to where market is pricing than the Fed put. In my view, the Fed put gets struck way lower than here, because inflation is running above target and the labor market is still fine. So the Fed really has no reason to be providing accommodation to this economy. Treasury's put is at a higher level. And we're just trying to find out, where is that put? Is it at 5% on twos? Is it at 5% on tens? Is it at 5.5% on tens? I mean, we don't really know, but we will find out. Does that put get executed next week by Treasury? It's possible that it will, and I think it would lead to another rally in risk assets. However, what it would also do is it would reignite animal spirits. It would reignite inflation expectations, threaten inflation expectations to become unanchored, drive up the gold price, drive up the Bitcoin price, drive up stock prices, and drive up actual inflation. So Yellen would be making a decision to say, I'm going to run this economy hot and inflation be damned. And I'd rather have an economy that's at full employment with inflation at, 3.5-4% and the S&P at, 5,500 or 6,000 and gold at 3,000 and Bitcoin at 100,000. I'd rather have that on November 1st than the alternative, which is, inflation at 2%, a little bit more unemployment, stock market down 20% from here. So I can understand why that political calculus is something that she might consider. I don't think she should do it, but I don't sit in her seat. So I'll just wait to see what she says and kind of react accordingly.
You just said stagflation could be a political maneuver.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Look, I think it's when you have 35 trillion in debt, right? I mean, yeah. and growing to 50 trillion in over the course of the next, I think, 12 years or so, based on the CBO estimates, the only way out is inflating the debts away. So, you know, the question is, can they do this in a way where inflation is not an election issue, is not a dinner table issue, is not a USA Today front page issue, because inflation is only in the, you know, 3% camp, and that's kind of close enough to 2, and certainly it's far enough away from 9 where it was at the peak 18 months ago. So it's like not really a big deal. Can they engineer that or not? And I think what the market's likely to do if they choose that stagflationary outcome is drive the oil price up higher, is drive commodity prices up higher. And so then, you know, we'll be dealing with $6 gasoline at the time of the convention in August, right? And then the administration will really be screwed. But they may choose that path. I can't rule it out.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible. The thing that's missing in here is the labor market, right? Like in stagflation, you have high inflation, sluggish growth. We just got the GDP numbers. So we know we've got high inflation. We've got sluggish growth, but the labor market is still really strong, at least depending on what data you want to look at. If you look at the most recent data, say strong, you look at the revisions 2 months later, it seems a lot weaker.
But on the cover, it looks
pretty good.
Yeah, look, I think it's better than people expected it would be at a 5% interest rate environment. Clearly, a lot of these jobs have been government jobs. Government hiring has been, you know, very robust. But construction hiring is pretty robust too. Yeah, there's a housing supply shortage in America, and so more houses are needed. So construction jobs are still in demand. I mean, I think big tech or white collar jobs, the growth there is slowing, right? Maybe AI has something to do with that. We just don't need as many six figure consultants or engineers if we have kind of supercomputing, taking over. And so I think there are some pockets of weakness there too. And certainly an economy at a 5% interest rate, there are different winners and different losers. But yeah, broadly speaking, I think the labor market is exhibiting more strength than not. So again, it's just, we don't really need more stimulus at this point from the Fed. And frankly, we don't need more stimulus really from Treasury either, but that's something that a path that they may choose. And we'll have to just wait and see.
A great, great conversation, Craig. I really appreciate your time. There's a lot, you gave me a lot of things to think about. I got to go back. I'm going to listen to this again myself and listen to you, because I think there's a number of points that I need to like go back and consider and put towards my own kind of thesis and how I'm approaching this. Really good points. Give us a sense where you write the Three Circles Investment Newsletter on Substack. You know, how can people reach out to you and pick up your work?
Yeah, you can find me there. You can find me on Twitter. I'm pretty active. The handle is CES921, which is my initials. And I also provide macro consulting services at LeDuc Trading. So where I provide kind of real time market color to our our retail clients. And so yeah, anybody wants to engage, as you can see, I don't mind mixing it up with people. And thanks for having me. It's been a great forum. Look forward to chatting again in the future.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. And I would say the Twitter handle is one. It's a follow. It's not only informative, it is also entertaining quite often. All right. Thanks, Craig. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Thanks, Trevor.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Mining Stock Daily and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.